Penguin Random House Audio presents Phasers on Stun, How the Making and Remaking of Star Trek Changed the World. This is the author, Ryan Britt. Author's Note: The bulk of this book was researched, written, revised, and edited between the summer of 2020 and the early months of 2022. However, I have been writing professionally about science fiction since 2009, and as such have interviewed people associated with Star Trek for well over a decade. When an interview subject is quoted prior to 2020, the interview was probably conducted for one of the following publications: Tor.com, Clark's World, Inverse, Sci-Fi Wire, or Den of Geek. In all cases, anecdotes or quotations appear in entirely different forms than they did in those publications, and, just as often, are quotations that did not appear in the final versions of those pieces at all. That said, I strongly encourage the reader to patronize those publications. Also, in all cases, interview subjects were made aware that they were speaking to me in a journalistic capacity. This book has been researched to the best of my ability and fact-checked by independent sources. That said, this is a work of creative nonfiction. And if there are any objections, disagreements, or errors, subjective or otherwise, they are mine alone and not the fault of my editors, publishers, or the hundreds of people interviewed in my research. Finally, because this book was completed during the airing of Star Trek Prodigy Season 1 and prior to the airing of at least two new seasons of different Star Trek series, Picard Season 2 and Strange New World Season 1, a few aspects of the franchise will naturally have changed. All parts of Trek change the whole, which, as I hope you'll see, has always been a beautiful and inspiring tradition. Ryan Britt, Portland, Maine, January 2022. Prologue. On a cold afternoon in February 2018, I looked out at the New York City skyline from my apartment in Queens as I held my sleeping 9-month-old daughter on my shoulder. I had to adjust her just right, worried I was going to wake her up. In about 20 minutes, my wife would be back from work, but the subway was delayed, and this important phone call was going to happen before that. If my baby woke up during the interview, the person at the other end would just have to deal with it. My phone vibrated, and as I answered the call, I wished I'd still had a flip phone. The voice at the other end of the phone was that of Captain Kirk. "This is Mr. Shatner," the voice said. Reflexively, because I'd watched Star Trek since I was 6 years old, I began calling him Sir immediately. I was interviewing William Shatner briefly for an article, mostly because of some voiceover work he'd done in a children's film called Aliens Ate My Homework. Weirdly, this movie was based on a series of children's chapter books that I'd read in grade school. Around the same time, I'd become obsessed with Trek. As a journalist, I'd interviewed famous people before. But Shatner was different. He was the captain. I was nervous, and my sleeping baby had started to squirm. I launched into my first question. I asked Shatner about his unique cadence, that famous, halting Captain Kirk thing he does so well. "People who have some characteristic way of speaking, to my knowledge, don't assume it. It's just there. And slowly they become aware of the fact that they may talk in a pattern that is uniquely theirs. In fact, even now, I have to turn to my wife and say, is he imitating me?" This struck me as both totally honest and bizarrely out of touch with reality. I laughed nervously. Shatner pretending like he doesn't know how he talks is like if Kareem Abdul-Jabbar said, "I've never noticed I'm tall. How strange of you to notice." Shatner and I talked a little bit about the science of plants and whether we'll ever be able to communicate with flowers directly. Around this time, my daughter woke up and started crying, loudly. "That's the cry of hunger," William Shatner said suddenly, the authority on my entire life. "You must feed her now." "Yeah, no kidding, Kirk. Thanks for the tip." Although I obviously was recording the call, I don't actually remember the rest of the phone call that well. I have Shatner's words and mine, but what I was doing with my baby while trying to talk to Captain Kirk is less clear. I do know that as I struggled with the bottle, Shatner continued to give me orders, becoming an on-the-spot parenting coach over the phone. Time began to blur, and I think for a moment I was caught between dimensions, kind of like Kirk was in the Tholian web. On the one hand, I was on the phone with my childhood. On the other hand, I was holding my child. From 1990 to 1992, I was Spock for Halloween 3 years in a row. I was never Captain Kirk, because I never really identified with him. I loved Kirk, but to me, Kirk was like somebody's dad. Spock felt closer to a friend, a cipher for the ways I could deal with whatever emotional trouble the universe threw at me. During my Shatner call, at some point, I walked to the living room and noticed a faded photograph of myself in third grade, dressed as Spock. I'm not smiling in this picture. No way. I'm Spock. My mom has wedged the store-bought plastic Vulcan ears to the sides of my head as best she can. She's penciled on the requisite upswept eyebrows, which look great on Spock, but just make a little kid look like a permanently angry Peanuts character. She's dyed my blonde hair midnight black, but Mom didn't have to worry about doing the Spock haircut. I'm a third-grade kid in 1990, so I've got that bowl cut anyway. In Star Trek's only true Halloween episode, 1967's Catspaw, Captain Kirk says Spock would be a natural for trick-or-treat, accidentally predicting a go-to costume not only for me, but for millions of people for over five decades. We never found out what Spock really thought about the human holiday of Halloween, but my third-grade self believes he'd be down to study the strange human rituals from the ground level. Spock finds this stuff comforting because experiencing human banalities just reaffirms that he's above all that shit. In this photo, I see my plastic trick-or-treat pumpkin sitting at my feet because I'm clasping my hands behind my back. That's the way Spock holds his hands in one of the famous photographs I had tacked up in my bedroom. He's pictured standing like this on one of the covers of so many of the dog-eared paperbacks that dominate my childhood home library. He stands this way in my favorite movie at the time, The Wrath of Khan, usually when he's about to say something awesome like, "The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few." Little kids with nervous energy never know what to do with their hands. Spock taught us all how to relax, or more accurately, to look like we're relaxed. What Spock taught me, and millions of others, was a badass version of fake it till you make it. But Star Trek isn't just an adult version of Care Bears. Its fictional world is about more than fluffy clouds and hope. Star Trek's power is in its humanist strategy. In order to live long and prosper, we must admit we're flawed. We are what we are, Captain Picard says in the 1987 debut episode of Star Trek The Next Generation. But we're doing the best we can. This sentiment describes all of us. From people struggling to get through the day, to the quest to find the perfect balance of mental health and the achievement of personal goals, to those of us holding babies, to those of us who just want justice and peace in our time. The world is not easy, but the heroes of Star Trek constantly provide us new tactics to rethink not just how we can succeed, but sometimes to alter the way we define that success. As a piece of journalism, my 2018 phone call with William Shatner may have been a failure, but it was a victory in another way. I remembered that my professional life and my childhood love of Star Trek were connected. Something that was once a place for imagination and intellectual refuge was now a building block of my life. My daughter's life literally couldn't have existed without William Shatner, without Star Trek. In The Wrath of Khan, Kirk says, "I don't believe in the no-win scenario," positing the notion that failure may not exist if we reframe the conditions of the test. In 2020, speaking to the official Star Trek podcast, The Pod Directive, Stacey Abrams pointed out that her inspiration in politics came from an episode of The Next Generation called Peak Performance. In it, the android Lieutenant Commander Data, Brent Spiner, plays a complicated and silly-looking strategy game called Stratagema. Although Data is a super-intelligent android, he is still bested by his alien opponent in this game. Captain Picard, Patrick Stewart, comforts Data, saying, "It is possible to commit no mistakes and still lose. That is not weakness. That is life." Abrams said she drew great inspiration from this episode because Data is compelled to investigate how he frames winning. Data wasn't going to play by the general notion of defeating the other person, but he was playing to stay in the game, Abrams said. "That was the responsibility I had as Democratic leader. We weren't going to always win, but we had to stay competitive." Star Trek's famous catchphrase, "Live long and prosper," doesn't evoke a belief in magic or a quasi-religious faith in a mystical energy field controlling your destiny. It's more about staying in the game. "Live long and prosper" is shockingly simple in its brazen sweetness. "Hello, my name is Star Trek. I'd like to encourage you to stay healthy, and while you're doing that, to have your life be as thoughtful and as fulfilling as possible." For me, a world in which Star Trek never existed is a timeline where my childhood collapses like dried Play-Doh. Mr. Spock and Data weren't just cool space superheroes to me as a kid. They were beacons of resilience. Kids can relate to Star Trek heroes without feeling like they're being talked down to. Adults can relate to Star Trek heroes because, unlike the perpetual coming-of-age stories that dominate everything from Harry Potter to Luke Skywalker, the Trek heroes are, for the most part, functioning adults. The love of Star Trek isn't about trying to recapture youthful adventure. It's an interest in stories that take place over entire lifetimes. Living long and prospering doesn't just mean getting older and not dying. It means embracing change. In the 1969 Star Trek: The Original Series episode, "Let That Be Your Last Battlefield," Spock says, changes the essential process of all existence.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?